This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Muhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
SMEs, they are fluid by nature. What you get is people just shift or they reorganize themselves. Typically what happens is people will leave. If something is totally not working, they leave it.
That was Farai Mutambaningwe, Executive Director of Zimbabwe's Small to Medium Enterprises Association, on how business flexibility is likely once the country's COVID lockdown ends. Details coming up. Also, the new United States Secretary of State Anthony J. Blinken has spoken with Egyptian Foreign Minister Sameh Shoukry. These stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. New U.S. Secretary of State Anthony J. Blinken spoke with Egyptian Foreign Minister Sameh Shoukry and highlighted the importance of the country's strong strategic partnership, particularly in security and counterterrorism cooperation. Blinken raised concerns over human rights in Egypt, but the Biden administration said it approved the sale of 168 tactical missiles to Egypt. The Egyptian Navy saw the $197 million sale of the Raytheon-made rolling airframe missiles to improve defense in coastal areas and around the Red Sea. David DeRoche, Associate Professor of the Near East Center for Strategic Studies, explained to VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi the justification for the arms deal despite human rights concerns.
I take the administration's statement at face value. It's important to know that this is a weapon sale of a weapon that has no real human rights implications. They're ship-borne anti-cruise missiles. So they're designed to defeat surface-skimming missiles like the Exocet. Of course, Egypt's primary maritime asset is the Suez Canal, and Egypt's ability to defend the Suez Canal is of great importance, not just to the United States, but to pretty much everybody in the world. So, you know, as the administration engages with Egypt, they want to elevate human rights, but at the same time, they want the Egyptians to know, look, we haven't completely turned our back on you. So a sale of this sort that doesn't have any, you know, implications in the war in Sinai or human rights violations is probably a test for the administration of how Congress is going to deal with Egypt going forward and how far they can go.
But President Biden has vowed a tougher stance on human rights after his predecessor Donald Trump courted Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, whom he reportedly called my favorite dictator. Department of State spokesperson Ned Price said, "We will bring our values with us to every relationship that we have across the globe, and that includes Egypt." How would the administration reconcile the two statements?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think what they're going to do is, first off, try to keep relations open with Egypt to let them know that the United States is still a security partner, but we're not a security partner without reservations. We're not one that just expects a value-neutral policy. So things such as this that really don't have implications in human rights, the administration will continue to do those and will cite when the Egyptians say, hey, how come we couldn't get some more controversial weapons? You know, the administration will say, well, we gave you the rolling airframe missile. We sold you that. The other ones, we have to talk about your development. So it's trying to stay engaged with the Egyptians while at the same time trying to modify Egyptian behavior, which is a very difficult thing, maybe impossible, but it's something that American administrations always think they can do.
Congressional testimonies in the past argued that Egypt does not need to buy more weapons as it's not at war with any neighbors or threatened by any external enemies. Would Congress approve this deal?
I think Congress will approve this deal. Egypt is not at war, but the time to build a navy is not while you're at war. It's about 5 years before you're there. And increasingly what we're finding are non-state actors posing problems. You know, any kind of a hostile action against the freedom of the seas in either the Red Sea or in the Mediterranean that threatens the Suez Canal, that would really disrupt the global patterns of trade. So I think something that reinforces Egypt's naval characteristics will be popular in Congress. I think there will be statements about Egypt's human rights records, corruption, the need to reform. But I think at the end of the day, the sale will go through.
That was David Darroch, associate professor at the Near East Center for Strategic Studies, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shenawi. A recent survey in Zimbabwe shows it will be difficult for many small businesses to resume operations when the COVID-19 lockdowns finally wind down. Reporter Kuzai Zanwashi has the details.
Christopher Mugaga is the CEO of the Zimbabwe Chamber of Commerce, which conducted the survey.
Our survey is very clear to say, look, we see a lot of business are not getting support. I think you know about the COVID-19. It came, then monetary policy came. It's very tough. It's a tight monetary policy. It's not supporting the sector because there's no credit expansion interest. It's actually moving up.
The survey estimates more than 50% of small businesses face challenges reopening. He ponders on government's efforts to salvage the situation. What's more, the monetary policy moved interest rates by almost 5%, and Mugaga says that has a negative impact on business.
Interventions are for government to then support the business. Is there efficacy or any seriousness on the part of government to solve it? I think there could be seriousness, but they're incapacitated. In other words, there's no fiscal space for government to support the private sector either through stimulus or through tax relief measures. But that's what we want to see as private sector. We want to see tax credits. We want to see tax relief measures. Like you see, if you go to South Africa right now, if you go to Europe, we also want to see interest rates being smoothened or becoming lower.
Small businesses have overhead costs, payroll, and other expenses. Small to Medium Enterprises Association Executive Director Farai Mutambanengwe says the informal sector may not be affected as much.
Obviously, there is a huge impact, but by nature, you see, SMEs, they are fluid by nature. What you get is people just shift or they reorganize themselves. Typically, what happens is people will leave. If something is totally not working, they leave it, or they repurpose their business. Informal, for your low end, what they'll simply do is they'll repurpose or they'll move into other areas.
There has been no comprehensive bailout for the businesses, and support has been scant for vulnerable individuals and families. Critics worry that the informal sector will opt for loans to resuscitate their businesses, but that means additional overhead in debt payments. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zunawashi from Harare.
Refugees and local leaders in Uganda's West Nile area are urging immediate intervention amid increases in sexual abuse of young boys and girls in camps hosting South Sudanese refugees. It's another nightmare for children still coping with the conflicts in their home country. Catherine Nambi reports from Kampala.
For those ages 12 to 18, home is a tent or less. Memories remain strong of fleeing violence. Schools are closed due to COVID-19. Adding untold sexual abuses in refugee settlements ranging from rape to early marriages. Some girls are lured into sex in exchange for basic needs. Moses Wenga is a refugee welfare counsel in Bidibidi settlement. He says the cases of child sexual abuse there are alarming.
5 months, we have registered almost 400 girls under the age of 17 who are defiled. So it means when the COVID continues, we shall lose our girls, even losing our boys who are also marrying these young girls to end in prison than going to school.
Josephine Angushia is the police spokesperson West Nile region, which polices the refugee settlements. She says that reports come in daily about sexual abuse among refugees.
We have so many cases of defilement resulting into early pregnancies and even teenage pregnancies. The cases have been common at the refugee camps, basically because of the conditions under which the refugees stay.
Some families have resorted to offering daughters as young as 13 years into marriage to older men in exchange for wealth. Angushia says they have intensified community policing among the refugee settlements to fight the sexual vices.
Because of that cultural norm, which is so much strong amongst some of the refugee communities, it has not been easy for defilement, early pregnancies, or early marriages to be fought. With those big numbers of refugees, we can't expect abrupt improvements or changes. It needs a continuous effort. The police have been trying to do their level best to sensitize those refugee communities so as to end the vice.
Wenga has made a wide appeal to fight all vices relating to child abuse.
The parents should take charge of the children. They should even monitor and give things that our girls or our boys need for their life. As a leader, we are following those who plan to have a marriage for our girls who are going to school. I'm not happy to see that a parent negotiating a marriage for underage of a child.
There also are concerns that the situation could worsen amid reports that the refugee funding is dwindling with the focus on the fight against COVID-19. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
Residents of Nigeria's northern city of Maiduguri say they still feel unsafe despite recent successes by the military against the Boko Haram terror group. The government on Tuesday announced the recapture of the strategic town of Mart in Borno State after weeks under control by the insurgents. For more on the security situation, International Edition's Chinedu Ofor spoke with public affairs analyst Abubakar Mohammed.
What I think more needs to be done, because some people in the society are still sympathetic to them. They're giving them cover, providing logistics, and so on and so forth. The terrorists are still around. The people in the society provide cover to the terrorists, just like how fish needs water to survive.
Has life returned to normal as you know it in Maiduguri and environs?
Well, for Maiduguri and Jere and with some of the local government, I believe people are doing well and okay. But to be honest, in some parts of the state, like Demotech, Baga, people are still trying to acclimatize. It's a traumatic experience and people are still antsy. People don't even know which way to go about.
Can you confirm that some people are fleeing from their villages into neighboring countries just to escape the onslaught of the Boko Haram terrorists?
At the moment, I don't think people are fleeing. Rather, I would say people are returning back from Niger, from Cameroon. There is no anywhere where I've heard that people are still running to, you know, neighboring countries like Niger and Chad and Cameroon. Initially, it happened last 2-3 years, but now they are coming back. Late last year, November, December, we have been seeing refugees in Cameroon and Niger returning back to Nigeria.
Is there any way to ensure that innocent people, villages are not caught up in this firefight between the Boko Haram and the Nigerian military?
Honestly, the Nigerian military has rules of engagement, you know, that tallies with international norms and standards. But for the insurgents, they operate in a way that I would say is simply barbaric, especially if they know a community, a society is collaborating with the military, maybe by giving intelligence. They can come and slaughter women and children. They don't care. And even among the insurgents, the ISWAP people are a little bit more saner than the Shekau faction, the ones they call themselves Jama'at al-Ahl al-Sunnah al-Da'wat al-Jihad. They are more crude, more barbaric in their approach.
There are reports that traveling, especially intra-city traveling, is really perilous and really dangerous. Can you confirm this?
I said it's very true because we have relatives, that friends, associates that travel every now and then. And I can tell you, traveling from even Abuja, the federal capital, to maybe Kaduna by road is now a nightmare. Most people would never do that. Same thing from Abuja to Kano to Bauchi. Then Abuja to Zamfara, okay. From even Niger, from one local government like say Kantubura to Shiroro or whatever, the bandits who I believe have connection with the insurgent, the Boko Haram insurgent, have perfected this craft because it's like they see it is more lucrative of coming to the road, attack commuters, kidnap them, and then, you know, begin to negotiate for ransom. So traveling on the highways is very dangerous. And most people are now, you know, traveling by air, and where they see rail transport is available, they go by rail. Honestly, it's not advisable to travel by route. It's very dangerous.
That's public affairs analyst Abubakar Mohammed speaking with VOA's Chinedu Afor from Maiduguri. The desire for economic growth and the need for land and natural resources are often considered to be at odds with the sustainable use of wild lands and their conservation, as well as wildlife. However, many economic and scientific experts say those priorities can harmonize to the benefit of the economy and the health of the natural world. VOA's Adam Phillips spoke to Kutsibwe Shibunyo, CEO and President of the African Wildlife Foundation, the largest African-led international conservation organization focused exclusively on the continent. Shibunyo began by stating its mission is to ensure that wildlife and wild lands continue to thrive in a modern Africa.
But what is at stake here is the decisions Africa is making around the economic aspirations currently are not factoring in the role of wildlife and wildlands. And a big part of our job is to ensure that wildlife contributes to Africa's aspirations, but also that Africans are aware that it's going to be very hard for us to survive on this continent without the ecological services that are provided by wildlife and wildlands. Africa has over 8,500 protected areas, not only for Africans, but for the global community. It's a reservoir for life.
What are some of the direct benefits that wildlife provides?
Benefits include direct uses like forest products, natural products, traditional medicines, and pharmaceuticals, as well as tourism. But the indirect uses are so many. Water cycles, soil fertility, control of soil erosion, carbon storage, and heritage, wildlife and wildlands for the continent, that is priceless. They define who we are as a continent.
So in your view, what is the single biggest threat to wildlife conservation on the continent?
The biggest threat today is coming from the decisions African leaders are making for our economic development. These next 5 years are going to determine the future of wildlife and wildlands.
What are some of the decisions you're referring to?
Decisions around urbanization, the decisions around consumption, the decisions about our high population, the decision about the choice of transport, the choice of energy, how expansive our food security needs are, or intensive agriculture we invest in, are going to determine the space left for wildlife. Decisions that we make at all levels, whether it's a household level, district level, or national economic development level.
So how do you address the big problem of reconciling the needs of a growing economy and its thirst for more land and more natural resources with the needs of wildlife and the conservation of land?
The problem is the forced choice. At Africa Wildlife Foundation, we believe they have to go together. For the ballooning population of Africa, you need water, you need good soil, you need rainfall. 80% of agriculture in Africa is rain-fed. If we don't conserve forests, we won't have rainfall. If we don't have rainfall, we won't have food security. It's as simple as that. Energy sources. If Africa is to industrialize, as our leaders are planning to, you need sustainable energy. Majority of Africa's energy plans are around hydropower generation. In Africa, most of the rivers' origins are from national parks. And we know that these rivers, to be maintained, you need these natural places. You need wildlife. But increasingly, we see decisions that are made are not factoring in what now we call ecological infrastructure for our economic development. They need the roads. They need the housing. They need the health infrastructure. They need agriculture infrastructure. Nobody's talking about the ecological infrastructure that needs to service the other structures.
So in a broad sense, what do you think needs to be done?
What needs to be done? We must all come together as the globe to understand that conservation is not about protecting wildlife animals. so that tourists can enjoy them. That's not the point. It's about protecting ourselves from environmental degradation. The biggest priorities right now should be restoring wildlife habitats, planning development activities and infrastructure in such a way that it does not compromise environmental well-being.
That's Kutsibwe Shibunyo, the CEO and president of the African Wildlife Foundation, speaking with VOA's Adam Phillips. Farmers in Nairobi have opened Kenya's first open produce market, selling their goods directly to customers. As Victoria Amunga reports from Nairobi, the Nairobi Farmers Market is selling directly to customers dealing with the economic impact of the pandemic.
Okay. Nairobi resident Fabiano Mbiri shops for groceries at the open-air Nairobi Farmers Market. Newly opened during the COVID-19 pandemic, Fabiano says the market helps customers buy directly from farmers at lower costs.
I like the fact that the prices here are, I can say, controlled in a way, because they do have, you can't come and just put a price on your items. It has to make sense to the customers. It has to make sense to the other sellers.
The Kenya National Bureau of Statistics reports more than 1.7 million Kenyans have lost their jobs since the pandemic began. Farmers Market Manager Jeff Mundia agrees most customers live on tight budgets.
We're finding a lot of our customers are coming back and keep on coming back, really appreciating that, especially within the COVID frame that we're working with. I think a lot of people are appreciating any kind of saving, especially actually in January. We had a lot of people who would say, I mean, they're very happy to find these prices because a lot of kids are going back to school, so bills had to be paid. The last thing you want is to overpay for your food.
Leaders in the fresh produce industry support the modern market and the measures it takes to prevent the spread of the coronavirus. Okisegere Ojapat is the CEO of the Fresh Produce Consortium of Kenya.
The most critical thing here that is all of us are going to ensure that we comply to certain regulations that have been put in place.
For Kenyan consumers, dealing directly with farmers is a welcome option that helps save money. Consumer Brenda Kichamu shares part of her experience.
I'll speak on the vegetables. The vegetables are pretty fair if I'm comparing to the places where I've been shopping before. So for me, that's more convenient.
Farmers too find the market a better option. They can maximize their profit by selling direct to consumers, eliminating brokers. The Farmers Market Management hopes to open more branches in Kenyan towns in the future. Victoria Amunga for VOA News, Nairobi.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.
Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
The Voice of America's Global News Program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest news stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. Our correspondents gather the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 3:30 and 17:05 UTC on The Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bubu music to hip life, bonga flavor to sukus, Afrobeat to ndombolo and makosa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the